And we've always had that choice because we've had David Terachuk with us for many, many years. And David not only looks at the media here in the United States, but at a worldwide view. He's served all over the world and been all over the world. He's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, has his own website, themediabeat.us. And once again, it's great to have him join us this morning, once again from Europe. Good morning, David.
Well, yes, hi, Marshall. I'm glad to be conversing again with the keen wits of Marshall Miles this week from Europe, as you say, and in fact, no longer. I mean, not for a while, anyway. Not from the media capital of the world, New York City. No, I'm on the road, and I'm coming from Dublin, Ireland, in fact, as in recent weeks. And, of course, in Europe and, I guess, worldwide, the Ukraine war is still dominating coverage. As if it wasn't enough, Russia's overall offense to world opinion by invading a neighbor and committing war crimes as they go, that become clearer to the world's media, these war crimes as they're in retreat, have been in retreat. And as if that wasn't enough, media throughout Europe have been outraged by one particular Russian action carried out just now. It seems to have been a deliberate outrage to world opinion. I'm talking about the Russians firing missiles into Ukraine's capital just as the United Nations leader was making his peacemaking trip there, just after, of course, he'd been in Moscow talking with Vladimir Putin, hopefully, about peace. And as I heard one commentator on Irish radio this morning saying it wasn't a mistake. It was a military analyst speaking. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an accident. You don't accidentally fire missiles into a city from 100 miles away when you know a global dignitary is there who you've just been negotiating with yourself. And of course, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, was particularly sharp in pointing out what he thought had happened. He said, he told journalists, this says a lot about Russia's true attitude to global institutions. I think we would probably agree with him. He said that the attack was an effort by the Russian leadership, he said, to humiliate the UN and everything that the organization represents. The Secretary General of the UN himself, Antonio Guterres, the guy making this trip, has been quoted saying that he was shocked by the missile strikes, but not because I'm here, he said, appropriately enough, downplaying the personal angle at least, but because Kiev is such a sacred city for Ukrainians and indeed for Russians alike. It's all part of their joint history.
You know,
what's very clear is that the measures that Guterres was trying to negotiate, possible ceasefires to evacuate civilians and injured soldiers, are just not realistically going to get anywhere with the Russians as they just forge on with their new wave of attacks concentrated on the Donbass region now in the east.
You know, and what's interesting, the media is not really covering this over here, but since we've scanned all these networks from Europe, we have been reporting and passing along to people that not only are the Ukrainians fighting back in their own country, but over the past 8 days, 5 different military targets in Russia, 1 military chemical plant, 1 railroad line, have been attacked. One as far as almost 200 miles inside Russia. Ukraine has not taken any bow for these, but you know, and Russia now with Vladimir Putin, it's obvious he's reached the end of his patience because of the edicts he's made. But you know what I don't understand with all the other terrible misjudgments of Vladimir Putin going into Ukraine. Did he really think that sooner or later, with the help of Europe and with the help of NATO, that Ukraine would not strike military targets in Russia eventually? I mean, how many times can you be slapped in the face before you slap back?
Well, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. It depends how much of a masochist you are. And oddly enough, you know, dictators can often develop such thick skins and that they don't seem to care what happens in response to their actions. And you know, that brings me to another idea about, you know, how the effects of this war are spreading unforeseen. In fact, because we didn't have any occasion to try and foresee this came as such an outrage, I think. Although you know, close observers of the scene knew that the invasion was coming, and it would have terrible implications. But I just humor me for a moment, because I've been really impressed by some Irish coverage of the situation as a whole now, and there's a word that keeps coming up increasingly as we take in more and more news of this war, and that word is famine, and it's very redolent here in Ireland. Famine in Ireland in the 19th century was one of the main reasons for so many Irish emigrating to, among other places, the United States, of course, making up a huge influential segment of our population. Well, famine devastated Ukraine, too, in the 1930s, under the Soviet dictator Stalin. Many Irish people have blamed Britain for many years as the colonial rulers then for exacerbating, if not causing, their famine. And Ukrainians have wholeheartedly blamed the Soviets for absolutely causing their famine. Stalin, in effect, ruthlessly seized the Ukrainian grain harvests to feed the Soviet populations that he favored, leaving the Ukrainians themselves to starve. And in Irish media this week, it's being pointed out that, you know, in a kind of grim solidarity, that the two worst famines in modern Europe have been in Ireland and the Ukraine. It's perhaps no wonder that there is so much fellow feeling, as I was describing to you last week and the week before. The media has been full here of stories about Ukrainian refugees being given homes now in Irish communities, some in quite small rural communities, not just here in the capital. And it's also being pointed out that in this current war, Ukraine's harvests are newly, once again, at great risk. Yet another misfortune and horror to deal with on top of the war itself. And the danger stretches far beyond Ukraine itself. There are worldwide implications for this. The country's long carried the label the breadbasket of Europe because of its vast plains of grain-growing agriculture. You might say it's breadbasket to the world, too. Those vast steppes of the region, as they're called, spelled with a double P-E, they provide about 30% of the world's wheat and barley, and also a fifth of its maize, by the way, and more than half of its sunflower oil. So now, because of this war, prices of grain are soaring, and they're already 34% up on last year, and they're at the highest level ever recorded by the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization. Africa, especially hard hit, but other regions too. The number of people experiencing severe hunger has increased in the last 2 years by 46 million people in Africa, about 57 million in Asia, about 14 million in Latin America and the Caribbean. Global nutrition experts are predicting a vastly worsening crisis. I mean, the victims of Putin's war, in other words, are not just in Ukraine. The invasion of Ukraine will seriously deepen world hunger, too. Yet one more alarming consequence of this terrible calamity.
Well, the whole world, you're right, is being drawn into it, and not necessarily in a combat role yet, but sooner or later, David, this invasion, which they thought that they would accomplish in 5 to 10 days, and now people were thinking in months. I'm looking at articles that have been written across Europe and some here in this country, where if someone doesn't wise up sooner or later, this will be years, and it won't be a year's conflict like when Russia was in Afghanistan, or the United States was in Iraq or Afghanistan. It will involve NATO and European countries, and Russia and its allies, and the potential for a to a world involvement and something even deeper than we have now really rises almost every day.
Sure. I mean, the breadth of this is almost breathtaking. And you know, and every now and again, something crops up just to remind us how individual sometimes the focus can be, but with a very broad significance at the same time. I've been taken by the story of Dmitry Muratov, who's a rare phenomenon, the editor of an independent Russian newspaper, Novaya Gazeta. You remember he won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, sharing it along with the Filipino journalist Maria Ressa. He was attacked in a Moscow railroad station with red paint and acetone being thrown all over him. And this actually happened a few weeks ago now. But yesterday, just yesterday, in fact, U.S. intelligence services have concluded that it was the work of Putin's agents. It's definitely not an easy place to be an independent journalist today, today's Russia. Especially one brave enough to proclaim public opposition to Putin's war, as Muratov has been doing, at great risk to himself, quite clearly. And he's in a way sort of emblematic of the world struggle at play here. The forces of repression against human individuals and human people in concert as well with each other, trying to stand up for principles of democracy and free speech. You're right. I mean, the vastness of this outrage of aggression on a national scale is becoming global, and at the heart of it is bravery of individuals pitched against hegemony from Putin's Kremlin. It's a parable for our times, I fear, and as you say, it could just get bigger and bigger.
Well, here's the parallels that I see, and I'm not a historic expert on world wars or anything like that. But with every world war, whether it was World War I or World War II, there were other things going on in the globe other than one individual hotspot. And right now you have Russia invading the Ukraine and sorely needing some support from some country. You have China and Taiwan. That is a problem that is sitting out there at this very same time, with China looking at Russia, at what they're doing, and then China knowing that they don't believe in China and Taiwan. And just take a look at the different markets around the world. Never mind the fact that people can't get fed, but look at the major markets around the world. I mean, this is a very, very critical time in the world's history because there are so many differences. There's so many different things that are going on that can all evolve into a huge conflict, whether it's via digital, whether it's via economic, whether it's via dropping bombs or sending missiles, or even tactical nuclear weapons. We're just living in a strange time, and nobody even talks now about China and Taiwan.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's enough going on between China and Taiwan to certainly, we need to pay attention, and it's a mistake not to pay attention, not to talk about it. China's accusing Taiwan of playing with fire, and yet, we know that China is a much bigger, more threatening force at play, and trying to, ensure that in their propaganda in the China Sea area, they've been making it clear that they take a lesson from the Ukraine experience, that they, as the much bigger force involved, can continue to threaten Taiwan and prevent any notion of Taiwan independence ever happening. Not that Taiwan wants to go in that direction either, but there's a bellicose nature, a bellicose quality to the Chinese aggressive propaganda at the moment, which is clearly meant to cow Taiwan, and Taiwan is in that plucky role And we'll see. We'll take inspiration too from Ukraine as the plucky resistance. That's an explosive or an incendiary kind of mixture. And I don't want to be alarmist, but I can't help, rather like you, I can't help but see as I look around the world and see the parallels at play, thinking that we're in for a very rocky time. And everywhere, everywhere there are parallels to be made. We don't want to force them as too much of a constraint on forward looking. We don't want to mistake every similarity for a prediction that things will go exactly the same way in two different places. But on the other hand, there's something about the atmosphere of bellicosity, of warmongering, that is distinctly destructive to world cooperation. And that, I think, is why the United Nations Secretary General is having such a hard time. And yet his efforts and those of the other peacemakers who are stepping forward, even the Turkish leadership, I have to say, that we can only hope result in some kind of improvement in the situation.
Let's talk a little bit about France. What happened in... I hate the way I say
it. Well, a narrow squeak. Well, not so narrow. It was a victory that, 58% as against 44%, I think. I'm getting the proportions of the final result wrong. No, Emmanuel Macron, the centrist right president, has survived to a second term, which doesn't often happen in France. They tend to be pretty rough with their presidents, dispatching them after one term. Ever since 2002, I think, and he saw off the threat from the far right. But on the other hand, the far right, the what used to be called the National Front, the National Rally, as now, and the Marine Le Pen, that far right party has actually recorded the highest vote ever in its history. And it's disturbing to find that close to half of the French population, when it comes down to it, when presented only with a binary choice, would actually cast their vote for people who are, in many respects, just a very direct echo of the German Nazis who occupied France itself in the Second World War. It's a grim situation, just adding to that pessimism that I was just expressing about world, the global situation overall.
Well, and you can compare it to really what happened in the United States. And this is not an anti-Trump statement at all. It's not. People know that I've never liked Donald Trump before he was president. But this isn't about Donald Trump. It's about all those Americans back in 2016 who felt so disaffected with what our government was, with what we were doing. The same thing happened here, and the same thing is still prevalent here in this country, and you see it in France, and you see it all over the world. That I hate to say this, but people really have lost faith in their government and their constitutions, and in what their countries are all about. I mean, and I'm not saying that they were wrong to lose that faith or not, but I'm just saying it's amazing how it's just happened in this tidal wave.
Yeah, I could narrow the focus down a little. There's an example of the populist disaffection with traditional government at play here in Ireland at the moment. Up in the north of Ireland, we have some startling implications developing from what's happened in that part of the island. There are elections coming up next week in Northern Ireland. And what we're going to see, I can confidently predict, is that the one-time violent rebels in that region become very likely the leading political party. Now, history tells us that the gradual and rugged end of British colonialism was filled with episodes where violent rebels were finally installed as the new rulers of a liberated country, like, for instance, Kenya, Zimbabwe, South Africa, although in that case it took a whole century to happen in a very protracted liberation war. But Northern Ireland is still a British possession, but the political party, Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which was at war with Britain for 30 years until the peace agreement right at the end of the last century, is now in a remarkable position. Sinn Féin is poised in these upcoming elections, according to reliable opinion polls, to be the victors in next week's election, and thus possibly lead the region's government in the future. A massive, massive irony at the very least. Now, whether Sinn Féin can actually get to hold the reins of power is a matter hemmed in a bit by the peace agreement under which Northern Ireland has lived relatively quietly for the last two dozen years. The executive running the province was designed in this peace agreement to be a power-sharing executive, a coalition between opposing parties, in other words. There was to be a first minister, called first, just shaded a bit differently from prime minister. There's only one of those in the UK as a whole, of course, and it's currently Boris Johnson. But there's meant to be also in Northern Ireland a deputy first minister too, and they have to act, and it will come from a different party, and they have to act in concert. And that's the traditionally seen as the Catholic-Protestant divide that is brought together in this power-sharing arrangement. Now, whether Sinn Féin can expect their archenemies on the other side to come in and join them is far from certain. Number two in the polls are likely to be the present-day versions of the late Ian Paisley in the Democratic, so-called Democratic Unionist Party. Remember Dr. Paisley, the booming voice of outright loyalism to British rule, the resounding slogan, no surrender. Well, the loyalists are also angry about some fallout from Brexit in that populist kind of uprising way that you were talking about. And the Brexit is a consequence of all of that, but it has an unforeseen consequence in Northern Ireland that it has very definitely infuriated the loyalists. They feel desperately let down by Boris Johnson, and they're saying that they're not going into any partnership, any power-sharing arrangement until their disaffection with Brexit's effect on Northern Ireland, what's called the Northern Ireland Protocol, is sorted out to their satisfaction. So we'll know by the time you and I are speaking next week what the results of this election are. But it doesn't look anything but a remarkable overturning of the traditional order. And you know what's interesting is that Sinn Féin has also been making great advances here in the south too. It's now the biggest party when it comes to public opinion polls too. So when they next get a chance to vote in here in the south in the Republic, we may find we're in a most extraordinary position of the Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army, in control of the territory. You know, regardless of the border, they will be in control right from Cork in the south of the island to Coleraine in the far north. Talk about a topsy-turvy world. It's just unrecognizable compared with anything we might have expected when the troubles of Northern Ireland were raging in those six counties in the north.
Now, this might sound a little trite, but in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to throw this sidebar in, and that is, it's obvious Queen Elizabeth is nearing the end of her, 70 years in power. That is another thing that, even though it's a monarchy, it still will affect the psyche of what goes on in Great Britain.
Well, I'll report back to you next week. Not only will the Northern Irish elections have happened, there will be regional and municipal elections in Britain too, and that will be some kind of measure of the political mood in Britain. In a way, attitudes to royalty continue in their own sweet way in Britain, irrespective of party politics. But I think there's a general disaffection with leadership overall, and I think some cynicism. And I, last time I was talking about royalty to fellow Brits, I mean, I'm originally a Brit at least, although I'm a proud American citizen now, it was interesting to see how some of the respect, I suppose the word is, for the institution of the monarchy has certainly been tarnished over the last couple of decades. The royal family is not exactly a model of good governance or even decent human behavior in many respects. And I think people's attitudes towards the institution are just not as respectful as they used to be.
Interesting 25 minutes, David. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll speak to you again next week, and we'll see what the world brings us in the media.
I'll do that very happily with you next week.
Take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. And The Media Beat is available at robinhoodradio.com as well.